Well, you got it on now?
Yeah, got it on.
Listen, George, honey, how loud should I talk?
That's fine, right like that, yeah.
And, of course, the first year was here, 1940, and then Missoula in 41. Then after that, for 2 or 3 years, this smoke jumping, because on account of the war, the smoke jumpers actually here kind of died down. And Francis and I would cargo half the night, getting cargo ready, and we had planes that would come in, and we'd drop the cargo for 3 or 4 years. During the war times, we'd bundle cargo at night and then drop it in the daylight, three times, from planes from Idaho and Montana.
Two fires.
Yeah, two fires. And we was just about the sole force here at that time, until they started coming back out of the service, and we started getting the conscientious objectors that was, I don't recall, Francis and I recall the when and who started, but they started getting those in here. Then that made, they volunteered to jump, you see, but they wouldn't fight in the war, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then, that brought it on a little more strong about the time the war was getting full blast and pretty near over 42, 43, 44, 45 of them in here. So we were just about the full force here for those 2 or 3 years. Then they started out for life, and then I turned to observing, and Francis took over the airport, the jumper business. And for about 5 years, I guess, I was the observer here. I don't remember just the exact date.
Great.
And then I went into the construction end of it, and we had the road crews and so forth. And we'd come up here, and Francis would get a bust or something, we'd come up here with the road crew, and they were pretty good in cargoing, see, so he'd call me, and we'd bring the road crew and do the cargoing, and then they, several of the road crew got to ride and do some of the dropping, too. And I continued that until about 1948, then I went solely into road construction. That's about it.
Great. Well, tell me about your training when you started out.
Well, somewhere around here, they got a ripcord that I lost.
Oh, really?
The first time.
No.
Out here on the airport somewhere. They found it about 20 years afterwards.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I jumped out and I jerked that ripcord just as hard as I could jerk it. When I jerked it, I lost the darn thing.
And did your canopy open?
Oh, yeah, it opened, all right. And Frank Berry had said before that, he said, don't lose the ripcord because it just puts the chute out of order. We're one short. So I tried to grab the darn thing, but I missed it, and it went on. And they asked me after, well, what was you grabbing at up there? I said, I lost the ripcord. Tried to grab it. And I don't know, we just jumped here again.
You were using ripcords up until when?
41.
Up until
in Missoula, they started the other. And we still had it. That was 1940.
Mm-hmm.
We was here.
What was the basis of the program? What did you see as the plans for smoke jumping? Of course, it's easy to see now, but what did you have in mind when you started jumping?
Well, I'd been on quite a lot of fires from way back in 1929. I was on the Remo Lake fire and Ashenola fire and some of those for run. And then I was in the Hidden Lakes, and hiking in there 10 or 15 miles is quite a little chore. You know?
Yeah.
And then you get in there and you got to hike back out and after the fires and you're in there. So anyway, to be hiking looked like a good thing to me to get people in there. And during the late 30s, Roy Mitchell, he was the assistant supervisor, he had a pain of his own. And I was on the Robinson Creek fire in here towards Hart's Pass, and he flew over, and I ordered some stuff. We had a messenger come out. You didn't have the radios then, and they was getting radios, of course, at that time. But so Roy come in there in his own plane, and he dropped a little package of cargo in there. So that was quite an. He was pretty interested.
With a little canopy.
No, he just dropped the
free fall.
Yeah. The package. I forget what was wanted anyway. And then he dropped the darn stuff to us. And he was flying around and observing the fires and things like that on his own, more or less, you see, too. So that kind of, and I was, well, I knew Roy real well and had talked to him then during the 1939 training jumps that they had here. My younger brother was one of them that was hired by the Dairies to do the experimental jumping.
Oh.
So through him, and I was living up here to Winthrop, and he stayed there with me, and that's how I got right in first-hand stuff on it, as far as that goes.
Oh, that's great.
And then, knowing Francis, Francis and I had worked for the district on the trails and stuff like that together, you see. And so I was pretty well hooked up on that point of it, too.
Yeah. What kind of training did you go through?
We went through, not too much. They were afraid to give you too much knowledge all at once, afraid that you'd forget the most important part. But they trained you here and mostly how the position to get out in, because those old Eagle parachutes would sure open on you. You could hear them clear up on the hill of town when they would open, you know.
Yeah.
And you're pretty green or black and blue around here under your arms from where those harness hit you at that time. So the main thing was the position and to be sure you cleared the airplane before you, and to get one, two, three, or whatever, so that you'd be far enough from the plane that you wouldn't hang up in the plane. And no one ever did. They were pretty, I think it was a real successful training program that the Dairies put on. And there was Frank and Virgil and Chet Derry, and Glenn Smith was the main. They were professional jumpers before they came and took the contract.
Oh, they were?
Yeah, they took the contract for 100 jumps in the timber to see if it could be done.
Right, yeah. Into the timber then?
That was into the timber here. That was, and that's where Lufkin got into it too. He was retrieving them guys. Of course, he was out on the Winthrop district and he knew the forest and he knew where they were jumping, and he was a telephone man and had worked the trails, and also he knew how to get up those trees. One tree up in here, then some guy lit in the snag, I don't know who it was anyway, and they had to put guys on it to keep it from falling until he could climb up there and get the chute out of it.
Oh, yeah? Oh, no.
So Francis had to. Then, of course, he stayed right with us, and for 3 or 4 years, I guess, him and I was just about the sole force here.
Wow.
But that wasn't so much jumping, just the cargo that had to be dropped.
Right, yeah.
But then when the jumpers did start coming back and getting them in from the service and all, why, it changed the picture quite a bit and pretty fast, of course. With the conscientious objectors, they come in here and they done a pretty good job, you know. They weren't afraid to jump or anything, but they just, that war was their religion and their belief, and they just wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Huh.
One time, they had a big fire back here on Bald Mountain, or back in the Ashenol and Forsaken area, and they had a bunch of Negro parachuters trained for firefighting. They were stationed at Camp Pendleton, California, I believe. So Francis and I went to Wenatchee and met them. And they had three plane loads of them coming in here in the C-47s. So Francis come in one and dumped his load and went back for the second load, and I come in with the second load and dumped it right behind him. So we, at the time he got back, and I was clear out of here, went back to Wenatchee then. So we had 150 men on there, and pretty fast.
Yeah, I bet. So you were a spotter then.
Yeah, we were the men. They were good Army pilots, but they'd never done anything like that. So that was all new to them, getting in on the mountains, flying and stuff.
I heard recently of the 1945, one of the black, from the black battalion, got killed. Falling through a tree or something like that. Do you know anything of that?
Well, they got, two or three of them got boogied up, but I didn't know one of them got killed. I didn't know that.
That's,
he might have. It was, I might have forgotten it by now, too, you know.
Yeah.
They jumped and came out to the Poseidon Airport. Went too far from there where they could hike down to the Poseidon Airport. Could have been one of them killed. I know there was a couple of them got hurt, and they had to take them horses to get them out of there.
Wow. So, What happened on your first jump? How was that?
My first jump? Well, you're on the airport?
Yeah.
Oh, well, by golly. They had a little travel air that they were flying. They weren't flying the 47s or any of that stuff from that time, or the Ford. Just had a travel air here, the Johnsons in Missoula.
Right.
And that's what we took our training in and all of that. Then we flew over here, and I don't remember who was with me. I think it was Glenn Smith. I'm not sure. And when we got over, I said, whenever you're ready, and I just took off. I was over the airport. So
nobody spotted you. You just...
Well, you know, you could. We was looking. There was some haystacks around. We had one particular haystack. I'd heard him talking that that's the place to get out over that haystack. So I got all over the haystack. But it seemed to me like, oh God, I was a sure traveler. The wind whistling by my face, you know. I said, oh man, but I was in a good position, straight up and straight down.
And that was that first jump, the one you lost your ripcord on?
No, I think it was the third one. I think before. I lost my ripcord. I think it was. No, I don't think you could have pulled that ripcord out of my hand the first time. I had a pretty good hold on it.
I bet. Did you have reserve chutes?
Yeah, reserve.
Yes.
Yeah, Francis one time, I know, his chute wasn't opening, and he pulled his reserve and went clear across the river in an alfalfa field over here and left the irrigating ditch.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So you couldn't control him very good if your other chute. He couldn't get his other chute pulled back in after you.
Oh.
And there was a little bit of a breeze, and he went clear on across the river, clear on the other side over there, the field. Went out from the irrigating ditch.
Yeah. Of course, you had no steering either at that time.
No, I don't know. I suppose it was, I don't know whether it scared us or not. I suppose we were probably too dumb to be scared, I guess.
Yeah. So, did you ever, or anybody you were jumping with ever get injured?
Over in Montana on the Deal Creek Fire. A fellow by the name of Roy Abbott got his leg broke. That's the first jump we made in Montana, was on the Deal Creek Fire, and it was a project fire, and there was a bunch, I think about, all the jumpers, I guess. There was 18 or 20 of them or something, I think, there at 9 Mile at that time. And they all went on that fire, and Roy Abbott, I think, broke his leg. He hit the snag, and it fell with him. A chute draped over the snag, and down he come and broke the leg. And that was the only one that was really hurt, really seriously, that I know of, enough to be having a leg broken.
Yeah. Did you pack him out?
I don't remember how he came out. I think I didn't pack him out, I know. But some of them must have packed him on down to where, to the trail, where they could get a horse.
Yeah.
To take him out to the, that airport, I don't remember. No.
So how about your first fire jump?
Oh, the supervisor, Roy Mitchell, assistant supervisor, was with Virgil Derry and I. And we went up here on the fire, and we circled it and picked out where we was going to jump, and it was even the jack pines, lodgepole. And here was a green opening, so we decided we'd go into that green opening. And so I cut out of there, and then Virgil followed me in, and gosh, we got down there, still old then. We could see that there was a small lake there covered with tules and things.
Oh, no.
So we went in about 3 feet, or 2 or 3 feet of water, got mud down there. We couldn't get out away from then. After we once started in, it was too low to get out over the top or get away from it. So we went right on into the... And they was wondering up there, because they circled us quite a while, wondering what was keeping us so long that we didn't get out of there. We was getting out of the water and getting our chutes out of it. So.
Yeah. Was that a... No spotters at that time? Didn't have anybody?
No, we just... Yeah, Virgil, I suppose he was spottering. He was the more experienced, you see, of course, and so... But I just, I think that I just figured when I was over there, could get in or something. Because we'd had, I think, seven training jumps here. So you pretty well depended on your ability then on your own.
Yeah.
And the spotters come, of course, later on. And I guess maybe Missoula picked that up too, more than we had here.
Did you throw streamers out? Or
yeah. You could throw a streamer out and get the wind drift.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. The Derry's... had that pretty problem with the studio.
Were they part of the fire organization then? After
no.
They just ran the.
They were completing the jumps for this 100 jump training to see if it could be done. Then, at that time in 1940, this spring of 1940, they always had fire training camps, you know, in the summertime to train all the fire smoke chasers and the lookouts and the, and the personnel on the districts or on the whole forest. And this fellow, the head of the fire control from Washington, D.C., David Godwin was his name. And he came out here. And he was here. And so the forest, the fire control officer, Anderson, Walter Anderson was his name, decided we'd go to training camp where everybody was there the first morning, that we'd have a smoke jump. So he got up on the Salmon Meadows over there. They had the training camp at Salmon Meadows. He got there and started the fire. And we was to jump on that at 7 o'clock. So he had the smoker going pretty good. But we flew over. And David Godwin and Francis Lufkin and David, or Virgil Derry and I, was to jump over there. So we flew over. And Godwin was acting as a co-pilot, your observer, you see. And so, by golly, we flew over there, and I jumped out first, then Francis, and then Virgil come right behind him. They made this complete circle before, after I got out, before Virgil jumped, then Francis jumped, then he jumped right on top of him. So we all three came down, and Francis, between Virgil and I, and they had to kick his chute out of the fire there, out in the slope.
Yeah.
So we was getting in there. Godwin said, "That's good enough for me. Smoke jumping is in."
Huh.
He went back to Washington, D.C., and I think the next year, or maybe that same year, he was killed in an automobile accident. So it was kind of rough.
Yeah.
There was one fellow here that was from Portland office that died from a heart attack during the training jump.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What happened?
He was trying to get some pictures up here. I think his name was Logie Wernstead or something, I think his name. And he was trying to get some close-up pictures of the jumpers coming in. They were jumping in the back country up here above Tiffany in that area. And so he had run up the hill here to get this guy coming in, whoever it was, I don't remember. And suffered a heart attack. He just
running up the hill.
Yeah, not to know. That's the only bad thing really that happened during the whole business.
So yeah, that's not too bad. I mean, considering what could happen.
During this trials here, my younger brother Al and a local boy here by the name of Dick Tuttle were helping too with this, helping the dairy so they could complete their 100 jumps. You see, and so they. They neither one stayed with it. Dick was hurt the next spring of 1940. The rope broke with him and he fell and was injured and he never did get back into jumping. Then my brother, he went into the service and so he, his smoke jump could come in pretty handy there. He was shot down twice.
Oh.
So he knew what to expect from an from a shoot this year.
Yeah, I guess so. Huh. What did you do when you landed in Treat?
Well, you had a, they figured out a way to, you had a rope in your, on your leg, you know, and you'd tie that rope. They'd done some practicing around here at the airport and in town with the knots and different things and how you could untie yourself and unhook your, but you had to use leverage in order to release the pressure on the snaps so that you could unhook your snaps and get your chute off or get your harness off. And then come down the rope or something.
Yeah. Did you ever land in a tree?
Oh, yeah, lots of times. Then afterwards, we got to land, picking out, and we was getting in close where the fire was close to a bunch of these second growth field thickets.
Yeah.
Go right into there. And that was just like a featherbed landing.
Huh.
The chute would drape over them, and they was 15 or 20 feet tall, you know, and just about enough. I know I was dangling up here one time and a bunch of that second growth stuff and just enough to stand up. So that was the way that.
That's good.
Yeah.
I bet landings are pretty hard. If
sometimes it was, yeah.
Yeah.
And you had to learn how to fall, too. They taught you that in the training school. They probably still did.
Yeah. They do that out here. You did all that out there.
Yeah.
Did you have a shock tower to jump off of?
Yeah, they built one here. Not before that training. It was in the next couple of years that they built a tower here.
Hmm.
Francis had most to do with that. And the Darys were still over. They'd stayed in Montana then afterwards. And Francis took over the jumper end of it.
Yeah. So you helped to train the next group of people that came through.
Well, yeah, we both had to do with the next bunches that came in. Yeah.
And up until... You kicked cargo until about 44, and that was when...
Yeah, 44, 45, and they came back out. Then I was on an observer for about 5 years here,
mm-hmm.
it seems to me like. And then up until 46 or 47,
hmm.
and then I got more or less let off into construction on the fort.
Hmm. Any stories that you remember from those first years?
No,
fires
I don't think they'd be worth telling much.
No?
Because I'd been on a lot of big fires before this. That's why I said I hated to have to hike in there 25 or 30 miles when you could ride in and jump out and get depth. Yeah.
Right. And then you'd pack out your...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how much did that weigh? Quite a bit.
Oh, it was quite a little. It must have weighed about 80 pounds.
Hmm.
Yeah. Your chute and your gear and everything. They improve that gear all the time, though. Constantly we're improving and looking for better ways and better methods and things like that, you know.
What kind of gear did you have?
Well, originally they had a big old stiff leather collar to protect your face. Virgil Derry hit a tree up here pretty hard and he skinned the whole side of his face up, you know. And then they picked up the football mask, or the catcher's mask, and the football helmet, and for protection mostly, and that's would just come by hard knocks how that happened to get adopted, I guess.
Yeah.
Seemed like, because a lot of them lighten into that brush and stuff, you had to have something to protect your face, your head.
Hmm. And you had suits on too, or you
just... Yeah, you had suits on.
Padded?
Padded suits, and they kept improving that, and different materials and stuff. First they were old, pretty heavy, kind of a canvas duck.
Hmm.
And they'd put a pad on here, or on your leg, or on your knees, or some knee pads in your arms, or something to protect you. But it wasn't too good, a lot of that, because, well, it was just trial and error. You had to try this and try that, and if it didn't work, you'd try something else.
Yeah. Huh. So did you jump mostly in this area? What kind of range did you have when you were flying?
What kind of what?
Range. How far away did you go from here?
Oh, gosh. We, one time, there was about a dozen of us, left Missoula about 4 o'clock one morning, and I jumped on a fire back here, back at Spanish Camp. About before noon, I think it was.
Oh, yeah?
Something. There was quite a bunch of us come over here from Missoula at that time. And the whole plane load, anyway, an old Ford load, and I think there was about a dozen of us. Dick Johnson was flying the plane.
Hmm.
And I think they all jumped around here some in different places before it was over, within the next day anyway. Because they'd had a fire bust in here and they called us, and of course we come right from Missoula right in here and didn't take very long to get here.
Hmm. Did you jump two at a time then?
Yeah, two or three, I guess.
Hmm.
Yeah, seemed like. Usually one just behind the other.
Yeah.
Instead of waiting for them to one go down and make a circle, the next they got to, so they just kind of like the army. It was just two or three go right on out because you knew that you was get down there together anyway.
Yeah.
While the wind drift, you knew what the wind was, what the smoke was, and you could tell pretty well.
Right.
Didn't have to get too much wind drift for the chute because you could see the smoke, get a good idea of what was going on from the smoke.
Yeah. So how did you get into this? Just by being part of the fire district before that? And
yeah, I was just I'd worked for the forest. I was working on the Forest Service at the time. I was in the Passaic District in 1939, and I'd been in there for a couple of years working on the trails. And of course, when I come out of there in the fall, my brother and here, these guys was jumping right up where I lived on the hillside right back of me. And my brother was there, and of course I got all the dope on that, and And Francis, of course, he was right in among it, too, because he was working on the district, too, on the Winthrop district, because I was on the Forsaken district. So, of course, I know Francis, and we'd worked together, too, so he kind of got right in close on it, so I put in for the job the next spring in 1940. So that,
and he, and so we're assistant.
Yeah, the old ranger up there and the assistant supervisor were all interested in it, too, you know. They, the old ranger up there, he kept pretty close watch on things. And he, Francis at that time was, could travel over these hills like a coyote, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was a good climber and telephone stuff like that and trees. And mm-hmm. So that's one reason why Frank put him on the end of the that he did.
And how many people trained in 40?
Well, there was four of us here, and I think four in Missoula. I think it was four. It might have been six in Missoula.
Mm-hmm.
There was four of us stationed here that summer.
Mm. And then the next year?
Then in 41, we all went to Missoula. And they must have been about 18 or 20, I think, that time. I got a picture of them at home, but I didn't thought about how many there are. But there's 18 or 20 out to 9 Mile, the old CC camp.
Right.
9 Mile.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they, and you all had previous fire experience.
Yeah, they were trying to get guys with fire experience to be the jumpers, the firefighting techniques like that.
Yeah. Huh. What kind of jumps did you have out there? Any anything that's significant, like anyone?
No, I never did have, no.
Anybody you jumped with?
Gosh, I don't think so. I don't know of anything that was spectacular or anything that we did, yeah, no.
Well, that's remarkable that people didn't get hurt when they did. Mm. You did you ever have a malfunction? Or anybody around you have a malfunction?
Well, yeah, I can remember two or three of them where they kind of fouled up, but I don't remember now what they were. They were one, two shoots out at the same time or something like that was... And one, I don't know who it was, though, was here, jumped, and his chute, he didn't think was open, it was going to streamer, and he pulled his other chute, and about that time, they both opened.
Oh.
I think that's what happened to Francis, too, that time that he went across the river, but I'm not sure that that's it. But other than that, no, there was no pretty good jump. So.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty good. Your fire seasons were probably pretty... 4 months long, is it?
Yeah, usually figure on June and through August.
Is that how many fires would you get?
Oh, gosh. You've had a lot of lightning strikes. And there weren't enough jumpers in that time to cover too many lightning strikes by the time you went out and got back. So they had quite a crews around, too, that had been for years going on fires, you know, the farmers around here, they'd have their own horses and they'd go out and put out a fire. Well, they'd do that without ever being asked and all that, too. So, we never did have any great busts, but what we could control them.
Yeah. And then you'd hike back to Winthrop.
Yeah.
So it could be a long ways, or to Missoula, wherever you jump.
Yeah, we hiked back from the Dean Creek Fire. I know that was getting up be a long way before we got back to the airport there.
What's the longest pack out you had?
I don't know. That was probably it. Over on the Lean Creek, I guess. Because here, the fires I jumped on weren't too far.
Hmm.
We jumped up here when we come in from Missoula that time and jumped up here. A little camp we call Spanish Camp. It's quite a little notorious camp back in there. There's a bunch of sheep running in there. And these fires were scattered. There were several different fire smokes around. You could see one was coming down. So we jumped, and pretty soon I walked up to the sheep herder here. He said, "Where in the hell did you fellas come from?" He'd never thought about us ever jumping out of the plane, you know. So he was pretty badly surprised, too.
Well, so how long did it take you to get back?
Well, we died out in a day.
A day?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. That was about 15 miles to the road that met in place from Spanish Camp.
Hmm.
But then they were pretty quick, too, at getting in there with the horses to pack you out, because that was the one we only had. The pack horse could go right to where we were.
Yeah.
To pack us out.
Yeah.
And that's the way with Virgil Darien on that first fire that we jumped on. My gosh, we met the packer. He was coming in after our equipment when we was halfway out of there. You see, so he's coming right in there after us.
Wow.
Didn't take too long to get the fire out. We got out of the mud hole. Water.
Yeah. Wow. So, I talked to your son earlier. He's hoping that his son could jump so that he'd have a three generation. So how long was your brother involved?
Oh, all that fall. Mm-hmm. That fall of 39.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't in 40. He wasn't employed by the Forest Service. He was employed by the jumping outfit, the Berries, and that was all contract.
Yeah.
And that was just through 1939.
Hmm.
Fall.
That's good. Let's see here. What did you like the most about jumping?
Well, it was quite a thrill to jump, but it was quite a thrill to get in there, too, to on the fire so darn quick, and that you didn't have to spend half a day or all night hiking to get into the fire.
Mm-hmm.
But I know I'd walked into Hidden Lakes and into Ashenola and into those fires and Rima Lake. Some of them was a long way. That took you left in the night and walked half of two-thirds of the night, you know, or left in the middle of the night, and it was daylight when you got there, and you wasn't too good shape to start fighting the fire for a whole 24 hours, you see.
Yeah.
And there was nothing there, either. You didn't have any grub or anything. That was the main thing. You couldn't get anything to them until the pack horses or somebody come in.
Mm-hmm.
That might be 2 days, you know, before they got to you.
Yeah.
So, it was the idea of getting in there and have something with you so that you could get the fire out and wait for them to come and get you, man. That's about what it amounted to.
Did they drop cargo on your fire right after you jumped in?
Yeah, they dropped the cargo, your tools.
Yeah.
You see, yeah.
And that all was free fall?
No, they dropped the tools at shoot on.
Huh.
Because you'd break them up if you didn't.
Yeah.
See, they'd hit too darn hard.
Huh. And you jumped about what altitude?
Oh, about, you had to have, I think they had 2,000 feet you're supposed to jump in altitude. But we might have been a little shorter than that time of year.
Yeah.
But that'd give you plenty of time to get down. And if it's a kind of windy or something, you don't want to get too high because it drifts you off too high.
Yeah. You ever land in the fire?
No.
Yeah. What, did you ever come across any bears or other animals that ever give you any trouble?
No, not any. No, I met a deer one time, but she was kind of mad, but she didn't give me any trouble. I know why. My fire might have scorched her a little or scared her something too, or something else might have scared them too, you know, but I never did have any trouble, any exciting times, all right. Like that.
Yeah. Well, do you keep up with the other people who jumped around here?
Do maybe? I?
Yeah.
Oh, once in a while, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I see Francis quite often. We trapped together and hunted together, too. After that, I know one time we had our trap set out and going back there and made the rounds, and we come out here and had the Forest Service called and said that we got money to go on to work and we want you guys back on the job. And so I had to go back. Francis went to work and I went back and sprung the trap. We figured if they want us to work, we better work and not be trapping them still. But we hunted together. Honey, Francis and I got 11 cougars in 1 week that time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I had a couple of good hounds up here, and I lived up here at Winthrop. And a lot of the time I worked on the Forest Service ranch. See, I was working feeding the stock at the remount station.
Mm.
And Francis was working in town and around, and that is for the forest or on whatever. So in the wintertime then we'd hunt, trap, something like that.
Yeah.
Nowadays you only had the summer work job. You didn't have a year long, and Luckily, I got the feeding and the remount stuff at 8 Mile up here.
Mm.
So that gave me a year-long job, and Francis was right there too. Then it turned so where by the time the half time while they were getting here, where they had to get this loft together, and Francis was years of getting this stuff put together, because it was kind of like pulling teeth, you know, a lot of this stuff to come by.
Mm.
The machines and the material and of course a lot of the competition you got was people that didn't know what was going on, I think, too, you know.
Yeah.
They wouldn't, oh, what do they want, this or that or why or this or that, you know. And so it took a little doing to get your machines and your thread and your stuff that you needed to really run this parachute loft here with, too.
Mm.
Get the building. Well, we had to pack the chutes at Winthrop in the ranger station there in the warehouse.
Mm.
And car would be in the warehouse before there was anything here, you see. Mm. There was a little building set over on the river. It was washed away in 1948 when it come down. But we done most of the cargo and set up the loft up in the Winthrop warehouse where we can pack a chute, you know, and get the cargo right out of there and do our cargo in right there in the night.
Mm.
Have a room the next morning for dropping it.
Yeah.
And we dropped a good many loads of cargo there for 3 or 4 years.
Mm.
Just might say the two of us, really.
Yeah. What did you kind of developed that program then?
Well, it seems like pretty much, yeah. And we had a lot of help, you know, with other guys,
yeah.
And suggestions. And old Roy Mitchell, the assistant supervisor, he was interested in from the word go, you know. He wanted to see it go and
yeah.
Things like that, too. And the whole forest was more or less interested in it. It started right here, and they wanted it to continue, and if there was anything to it, they wanted to have a share in it, of course.
Yeah.
And the ranger and the personnel on the forest made quite a lot of difference, too.
Hmm. How did you do the cargo? What was the procedure for?
Well, we just had to get. I'd packed enough on the mules and horses and stuff, you know, and they come out with these new type of saddle, the Decker saddle, mm-hmm. of course, and you have to cargo that stuff to put it on a mule. So, mm-hmm. Coming cargo was kind of coming natural to me there, getting to cargo this stuff up. So we was pretty well new. Francis had been out there, and everybody else concerned had been on the trail enough, you know, to know by golly, you had to have the stuff taken care of, or you wouldn't know good to send something broken into. So,
yeah,
it was just kind of what common sense you had to be used. That was all it was to.
Right. What kind of packing did you do? Get it to
we used a canvas, heavy duck canvas, and ropes, matting ropes, you might call them. They called them matting for the packing for the Decker saddles, and you roped them up and done them in cargoes, you know. It took quite a load in order a stove and stuff like that, you know, stuff mm. to wrap that up so we could get the chute hooked onto it to stay. You see, that was one thing, to get it so you could put a chute on it.
Huh.
And still get it out the door with the time he got over the target, anyway.
Uh-huh. And you would pack those chutes and
yeah.
deploy them yourself as
yeah.
they went out
mm-hmm.
the door?
Yeah. We learned how.
Yeah.
They taught us everybody how to pack a parachute and the whole business, you know, and we had them right there. So maybe he'd be, Francis or somebody might be packing the chutes and the other guy would be doing the cargo and stuff.
Hmm.
Then after we got the more of a crew in here, why... Well, the road, as I said, the road crew took care of most of the cargoing, and of course they had the other in the loft had done getting the chutes ready and stuff like that. Mainly some of the jumpers here.
Mm.
There's a lot of them that stayed right here and still working, I guess, for the Forest Service somewhere.
Hmm. Yeah, a lot of people. when you threw the cargo out, is that... out of what kind of plane? Same as a jump plane?
Yeah, same as a jump plane.
Hmm.
Usually they'd get the jumpers out there then come back and we'd take the cargo and drop to them or something like that, you see.
You'd come back for the cargo then?
Yeah, they'd come back. And you could drop them their tools, what they needed, you see, their pack. And then if you was going to supply a fire camp, then you had to come back here and you get quite a lot of groceries and stoves and all kinds of equipment to drop into that fire. Like, you put 300 paratroopers in on the fire in there, you had to have quite a little equipment.
Mm-hmm. And then they had to pack it all out again.
They had to, at that time, they assembled it mostly in the packer, went into the airport and went with a string of mules and went in and packed the stuff down to where they could load it on the airport, Pasadena Airport, and bring it out here. That was a primitive airport back then. It was built. In fact, I was working on the airport in 1939 when the jumping first started. I was working in the Pasadena District on the landing strip for what is the Pasadena North Airport. But they let it grow up now. They've done away with it.
And just use this one.
Just this one.
Yeah. Well, tell me what you've seen as the changes that have happened in the past. During your involvement, during the time you were...
Oh, God, they've just more or less perfected the whole procedure, you know, from what it was. It used to be like any primitive undertaking on something new. Every year we saw a lot of improvement. And the biggest jump, I imagine, was from the ripcord to the static line. I think that was because you could, like some of them said, you just put the... push a sack of potatoes out of there, and you wouldn't have to be alive or whatever to drop with a static line. That was the big improvement. That took, I think, a lot of the hazards and the danger and the fear out of smoke jumping with the static line. They had they could watch here and they could see guys go out there, some of the new guys would ride along as an observer to see how it was done, and the guy jump out and he'd see what happened. But before that, a time or two, you didn't know whether, whether the guy was going to make it or not. If he'd had to use the ripcord, he might have jumped too quick or pulled it too quick or froze up a little or something like that.
Yeah.
But I think that was the biggest step, Paul, was from the ripcord to the static line, probably.
Which was about in 1943?
41.
41.
Yeah. Oh. The Army down Fort Benning, I think, tried that first. I think that's true, the way it was. I'm not sure. Anyway, when we went to Missoula in 1941, we started using the static line instead of the ripcord.
Didn't you do training for the military, too?
No, we could have. I was in the military, though, before, see? And then they had offered us commission, I think it was a lieutenant or something in the Air Force to go in, but I don't think very many of them wanted to get in the military.
They didn't.
In 1941, they called a reserve officer or two from Missoula, and I think it was two of them went probably over the smoke jumpers that were training for smoke jumpers over there in Missoula that had to go, were called to the reserves, and then they went from there, I guess, on into the paratroopers or something. I don't know whatever happened to them.
Did you, when you were in Missoula, did you jump mostly in the that area, right around Missoula, since you had to pack it off? You didn't go into Idaho or?
No. Some of them did. Quite a lot of them did jump into Idaho, and several of the boys that was there were from scattered clear out over Idaho and Washington and Montana, too, were the kids that were being trained in there. That Wagner Dodge, I think he was from one place, and he was in that man Gulch fire. He was a Mormon, you know.
He was one of the ones to be killed?
Yeah, and he was one of the ones that flew over here and jumped from here the time we come from Missoula, that plane load. And there was a lot of them that, this old Rufus Robinson, you probably heard of him.
Right.
He was there, too, at that 9 mile camp in 41, of course. And I think he jumped a time or two. He was from Idaho, I think, to start with. And I think he jumped in Idaho and then Montana both, I think, around. Pretty well scattered around at that time.
Yeah. What effect did the war have? It had a pretty big effect on the manpower.
Yeah, that's right. That's why they had to train these paratroopers to jump on fires. They trained them to fight fire is what they done.
Mm-hmm.
How good the firefighters, I don't know how they got, how good they were trained or anything. But there was pretty much of a skeleton crew, I'll tell you, when the war was on.
Mm-hmm.
Because till the conscientious objectors started in, then they kind of bolstered things up.
Yeah. And were you still involved then at
yeah.
that time?
Yeah.
You were doing the training and...
Yeah, I was here with Francis and I was doing mostly observing at that time and cargoing.
Mm-hmm.
And teaching them how to do cargo and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the whole bit, of course.
Yeah. Did you have a selection process on who would be a jumper, or was it pretty much whoever?
No, much. Francis done most of that. He was actually put in charge of the thing, Francis left.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would get the choice, and there weren't too many applications at that time, I don't think. I think he took pretty much everybody that come,
huh.
that applied for the job, I think. So you'd have to talk to him, but I think uh-huh. that's the way it was, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Quite a lot of faith, I guess.
And I was usually out on some project or working somewhere until the fire season started, you see, and then.
With the Forest Service? Then.
Yes, with the Forest Service.
You were working with the stock at that time?
Yeah, mostly on the stock, with the stock. But, and then until 1948, I went into the construction and maintenance,
right.
roads and bridges and stuff, buildings.
Yeah. Did you, did they use jumpers in rescue jumps then?
Yeah, I can't recall any of them, but I know they jumped. You mean rescue of other personnel?
Whether it's Forest Service or not Forest Service.
I don't think so. I don't believe so.
What about this, jumping doctor? Wasn't there someone?
Yeah, there was a, he trained.
Okay.
Well, the doctor, I think, was trained over there in Missoula, or in Idaho, one of the places, but he wasn't from here. And he was trained, and I think he actually did jump on a couple of them and get an injured man off at the mountain.
Yeah, packing them out, I guess.
Yeah, that was something else. Yeah.
Yeah. You didn't ever do any rescue jumps yourself?
No. No.
Yeah. Well, what was the most significant event in your smoke jumping career?
That'd be hard to say.
Or several. Can you think of any?
No, I don't know what it would be.
But how many jumps did you have?
19,
really? Wow. Can you remember any of them? If you can explain a little bit?
No, I can't remember anything in particular about them at all.
Just where they are, where they were with five fires?
Yeah, there was three or four over around Missoula. Out in there, and then mostly here on the Okanagan, or the Cheyenne National Forest.
They were land.
The rest of them.
Pardon?
The rest of them would be in here.
Hmm.
Yeah. But there was nothing very spectacular or anything like that.
Do you ever land in water?
Just in that little pond, the first
right.
pond, the first pond, yeah.
That was
Other
your first
than
pond.
That, no. Not land, no.
Yeah. During any of your fire jumps, did you ever have a tough fire that you needed to call in more jumpers or more crew?
God, see, I don't believe so. I don't think so, no. It was a little bit rough with a couple of them, you know, but By golly, we didn't have to call anymore. Mm. Unless they already knew ahead of time that it was going to take more than, to say, two men, and they'd send some more the next time around, why they'd send in some more. But we had radio. Getting into radio contact is pretty good with the radios, and you could call them if you needed help pretty quick.
You'd jump with the radio, would you?
They could drop your radio.
Oh.
And then you did have a radio that you could put on your pack or on your leg or something, drop with that too.
Hmm. Did you ever have trouble finding the fire once you were on the ground?
No.
No?
You could pretty well find it. You knew just about where it was at when you could see it before you ever left the plane. So you knew where you was at and what was around it too. You generally took a pretty good look at around the surrounding area to see what things could be like.
Mm-hmm.
And I know one time I was dropping cargo back in here on a fire, and the ranger off in the Poseidon district, he was climbing right up there. He was going to get up where he could look around, and I had radio in the plane, and I radioed to the ground and told him just get him the hell out of there, because he was walking right into it, right up there. If that fire blew up and come up the hill and took him right out of there. And afterwards I talked to him, and he said he didn't know why. He just walked up that thing and never once dreamed about the thing blowing up and catching him. But he just would do something like that. You know?
Wow.
They do have accidents happen, I believe.
Yes, right.
A few years ago over on Fish Lake over here on the fire base, some guys got trapped because they weren't watching. They got in the head of it, and she blew up and come right up, and they couldn't get out. So nothing ever very spectacular in my smoke job, as far as that goes.
Did you train other people to kick cargo then?
Yeah.
During your training?
I had several men on the road crew, my operators, you know, and they were pretty well, I trained them in cargo in here too, so whenever they needed a lot of cargo, and they were even dropping some cargo once in a while, I took them along so they could see how to drop it, what happened to everything, you know.
Yeah.
Some of them didn't like to go very good, but they, not long, but they were willing to quit the road job and come right in here and start cargo. And then Francis, you know, he knew that he had a pretty good cargo crew. Anytime he needed them, holler them. And I'd have some men here for him. Just, he was a cargo.
Yeah.
And of course, he had his men jumping all over the country. Well, they probably didn't have time to do much cargo in any way. So it made it work out pretty good.
That's great.
Yeah.
Still going today.
Yeah. I think that after I retired, I think that they still call the road crew in here to do the cargo.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. One of the operators that I had, probably the most experienced packer in cargo and stuff, packing on mules and stuff. You got to be a pretty good cargoer to pack on a mule and stuff like that, you know, and horse and stuff. So he'd been in that for quite a while, so he knew pretty much what to do and how to do it. And anybody, any of the rest of the crew come in and didn't know why, point up to him what, how to do it and how to wrap it and how to do that.
Yeah.
So we made it pretty simple. And I know the Francis and whoever was responsible here for it knew that they could depend on him to get in that car lot. So that made it pretty handy, and cooperation for the whole outfit too. Everybody was cooperative in this whole outfit.
Did anybody, any of the districts or any of the Forest Service personnel not like the idea of jumping particularly?
Well, I don't think so.
Didn't have any problems with that, getting funding and that kind of thing.
They didn't, you mean some of the other personnel on the force didn't like it, or how did you?
Yeah, or Washington office, or, I mean, once that guy saw it, he was pretty much for it, and you got the funding you needed.
Yeah, so, seemed like that, yeah. Of course, Region 1 was the one that got all the money. They got most of the fun and the glory.
Uh-huh.
And Region 6, of course, They done all right, but they could have, I think, had a little better cooperation, I'd say, from the bigger end of the state. I know it took a long time and hard work and stuff to get, seemed like, what we really needed there for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, nobody knew what they really needed, too. That was another thing. It had to be proved that you had to do that. You had to have it.
Yeah.
But it seemed to me when I was in Region 1 in 41 that they got put in anything they wanted. It might have been the personnel there, too, but it would happen to be the head guy, too, whatever.
Yeah. Did you do your own sewing of your suits and all that kind of thing?
We did, yeah.
You did that all here?
Yeah, up in the loft. Or up in the, it wasn't the loft, it was up in the warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
They had the sewing machine set up in there. And we learned to patch the chutes and so this whole business, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And did you get your chutes? Did you develop the chutes eventually?
No.
The dairies developed it?
No. This, to start with, this Eagle Parachute Company was the one that brought this chute out here. He was from Washington, D.C., and he was interested in this parachute business, of course, so he was the one. But no, I just learned, or we learned here through the dairies, how to patch the chutes and do the maintenance of them, stuff like that.
What kind of chutes did you use for your cargo?
They were ex-military chutes.
Personnel chutes?
Yeah.
Huh.
They'd been used or handed down for a lot of that with cargo chutes, yeah.
Were they 28 feet or so?
28 feet, most of them. 28 foot. And they seemed to have quite a lot of them because I guess they used a lot of them in the Air Force, probably in the paratroopers and all. So they got them in by quite the bunches of them. And I don't know, Francis was more into all that stuff than I was, so he done a lot of the ordering and the purchasing and I think along with the region did too, you know, so they figured they'd have to have so many or whatever. I don't know, I'm not too familiar with the ordering of the chute stuff.
Yeah. So what was the procedures for kicking the cargo?
Well, it was a little shaky there for a few years. We never had a parachute on or a barricade on the door or anything else.
You fell out, that's it. Huh?
Boy, I come pretty near quitting there too one time with a bunch of cargo in there.
Oh.
I was dropping over in here towards the head of Lake Cheyenne, and Dick Johnson was flying the plane, and there was two or three spectators along. One of them happened to be this assistant supervisor. And I just had the cargo pretty heavy, and I was getting right up to the door, and he had a air pocket or something, and boy, we went down, and I know Roy Mitchell hit his head. He was bald-headed, and he hit it on the top of the thing, and if I'd went out, went forward instead of backwards, I'd have went on out of there without a parachute.
Oh, no.
So that kind of makes you think, well, I better have a parachute on, or I better have something strapped in, so they got after that. Put on line on you so you couldn't get out the door or fall out the door or something, but this would get you a little dangerous in these rough canyons and stuff, dropping cargo in there, you know, it's pretty rough. You had to get down pretty close to hit a bad air fire, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I didn't realize till afterwards that was a pretty close call.
I bet.
I had all this pretty good sized package in my arms and scooting right up to the door when it hit, but the way it turned, it pushed me back instead of if I'd have went out, that would have been just it.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, so then that's what it seemed to take. But there wasn't very many bad accidents. It was one or two years that the plane went down. It was a pile of air up here on, killed three or four of them on the ridge of Edwards.
Was that when they had a rescue jump up there?
I don't think they had a rescue jump.
No?
They may have had a rescue jump. I wasn't involved in it at that time. I was on the road end of it after. That was after I got out of the forest fire control end.
Yeah.
But they hit the bad air and it took him right into the mountain.
How many years were you on road crew?
20.
20 years.
Yeah, 48 to 67.
Really? And then you retired from the Forest Service?
And I retired from the Forest Service.
Hmm. And during that time, did you kick more cargo?
Oh, yeah. During there, clear up until the last, well, whenever they had the firebugs or something in need of cargoes, why, Francis would call us, and that was the way we come, right? Headed for the airport.
Hmm.
It was kind of a break, too.
Yeah.
Get up here. You knew it was kind of interesting to do that work, too. I was kind of interested in, and the guys that had working with me was pretty well interested in that stuff, too.
Yeah. You never had any airplane malfunctions while you were kicking cargo?
No, not while I was kicking. Yes, I did. It wasn't me. It was a fellow down here that I gave him the cargo to drop, but they had a little of these bomb chutes. And I told him, now, I said, take this and drop it back here. And lack of instructions, I guess, anyway, it hung up in the tail of the airplane and they went down up here in the mountains.
Oh.
But they, luckily, didn't nobody get hurt.
Hmm.
Kind of boogered up the airplane somewhat.
Huh. So you had no control over the plane.
No, it had the chute hung in the tail of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a bad one. So they done away with, eliminated the bomb chute after that. But actually, it was probably my fault and the cargo dropper's fault, too. I didn't tell him how to get, told him how to get a hold of the cargo, just a small package with a little bomb chute on it. And to hold it and to get it below the door and all, so they have to be the dang wind caught it wrong or something.
Huh.
It hung up on the tail of the plane.
What's a bomb chute? Just a little package and it'll...
Yeah, it's a small chute that they use for just to tail and bombs down. That's Army stuff.
Army.
Chute. Then we hung up back here on the... Just dropping some... Wasn't dropping these... I was dropping a little cargo, yeah, one day back here, and the plane carburetor iced up, and we had to hit the mountain back here.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And we hit pretty good and stayed pretty good till we hit a big rock and broke the front wheel off, and then we poured into the dirt, but it wasn't too bad. Then we had to actually build an airport there for about a week to get to fly the plane out of there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
No.
We didn't turn over anything.
Huh.
You know.
So you just built the whole runway system?
We just had to build the whole darn runway. Just dynamite in there and blew the rocks out of the way and back on what's called Ball Mountain back here. That's where I went down.
Put a new wheel on the plane?
Yeah, put a new wheel. And then first time we tried to take her off, we cracked it in some more rocks and we had to rebuild it again.
Oh, no.
So it was two rebuild job before we could fly her out of there.
What was the biggest fire year that you worked with?
Fire year?
Yeah, what is had the most fires?
Oh, gosh, I wouldn't know. The biggest fires were some of them old-timers in 1929 and something like that. You know, they had some monstrous fire back in the back country there.
You weren't fighting fires then, were you?
29?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Really?
I walked in for about 30, from the end of the road up to 30 miles up here, 30 miles above Windsor, about 15 miles to the fire again. That's what I say, 1929, that's the fire again.
Mm. And how big was that?
Oh, God, I don't know. There was three big fires back there at that time. And they burned the whole thousands of acres.
Mm. Can't get too many people in by hiking them in.
It took a long time to get them all in there, and then a lot of them, you know, coming off the streets weren't capable of hiking that far, you know. They weren't dressed for that, they didn't have shoes for that, things like that.
Yeah.
So when they got the smoke jumpers, and you had to wear pretty good clothes and good shoes to hike with and jump with, and it made a big turnaround right there, I think.
Hmm.
Yeah. I think if there's a bad weather conditions and everything is right, but I don't think how many men you got out there is going to stop a fire. But that's, they got a better chance, of course, but I don't think they can stop it, no matter how many men you have.
Yeah. What kind of clothes and personal equipment did you have when you jumped?
No, just regular
thick
Levi's and overalls and shirts and
boots, long boots.
Yeah. We generally wore the kerns or the whites or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Whites were around back then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, the oldest smoke jump in the world?
I don't know. We're in around here because I don't know. It seems like I probably would, because I'm just about the age limit when I jumped, you see.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah?
How old were you when you started?
Well, in 1942 or 40, I would have been 34.
Hmm.
When I started.
Well, you could be. Yeah. So Francis is a...
Francis is 8 years younger than I.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Do you have anything that I didn't get about the training, your first training that you had? About procedures, you mentioned that you jumped out of a tower with a shock cord, and you did some practice on landing. Did you do other things, physical training, or?
No, I didn't when I was training. No, that came in afterwards. You may know him over. I don't know where he is now. Fred Brower from Missoula was quite a football player in his. And they done that in training for football, and he come in with some of his ideas, you know, on physical fitness and all. Of course, everybody knew they had to be in physical condition, but Fred Brower come in with some of that training sessions of that they had over there in Missoula.
Mm.
And he was going at that time, or just got out of the University of Fontana, that Missoula. Of course, Earl Cooley, too.
When he came in here and set up the tires and
do that stuff and all that.
So did you go that do that yourself?
No, I didn't. No, I don't think Francis did, or any of the older ones didn't. I think it was probably because we more or less the guys that went into it was been used to just climbing the mountains and fighting fires and things like that. But these other, you take them kids out of school or out of college, they've never really done too much manual labor, you might say.
Yeah.
And so, in order to get them in physical condition, they had to do this.
Mm.
Lufkin had a lot of them out here cut the sagebrush off this flat for 3 or 4 years.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them would get a little wise and kind of a big pile of them and get behind it and hide. It all was worth it. It was fun. A couple of them thought they would get out all morning behind the sagebrush, and honey come in and do it. He said, "Say, before you guys go back out, and I just want you to know that she was on annual leave this morning." So I they changed the vibe. They cut out for you could see a board, I think, after that.
Oh, no. So the average age of the people that your class that you jumped with was quite a bit older than they ended up being later.
Yeah, they were. Most of them coming in then right out of school, you know, or something like that, younger. Mm-hmm. And college. A lot of college boys, I think, for the first year or two came here to jump. And I know from all over. I know Francis has had some from way back in the east and scattered all over the country, you know.
Mm.
And they were college boys. They were going to college and getting ready to go to college. But when I started, I was clear beyond that school stage, you know, because when you're, I was married and had a couple of kids, you see.
Yeah.
So, 1940, yeah. So, it was a different, little different class, you know, older, more experience on working in it.
Yes, right. Huh. So when you were in you did the training for cargo up until 67 then?
Yeah, more or less, yeah. There wasn't much training after the guys got pretty well on how to do it, you know.
Yeah. So you saw a lot of changes in the way that you packaged cargo and all that kind of stuff?
Too many changes, no, but you saw quite a little difference in the cargo you packed.
Mm-hmm.
Because they come up here with all of these big man mess kits and 20-man crews and stuff like that. You see, you come out of the service. I think Francis must have got them with equipment, the big kettles and pots and cans and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the military, I think, is where he got that. So it was a little different cargo.
Yeah.
Everything changed more or less through the Dome Door.
Right.
20 years there, you might say.
Sure. You package it in canvas still? And
yeah. And they had, they built containers to put some of those big 2-man kettles in, or 10-man or 20-man things. And they did so that you could just hang them on a parachute and drop them, you see, and you had, they were insulated and hanging right and things like that, or sealed with cream cans or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Made quite a little difference in the type of cargo you had to handle.
Mm, I bet. So after the war, there was the people who came into jumping were fairly young and not from the military. I mean, they weren't really, at that point the COs stopped coming and
got
local people.
Yeah, and then you could get more or less of the locals, like around here, they'd pick up some, well, my son Raymond, for instance, he's just out of school, and a lot of them just out of school, you know, and wanting to get a job, and so the first thing they hit was a smoke shop.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they could make big money and have a big time of it, but they found out they had a little work to do, too, you know. But kids that were raised in the country knew a little more of what work was than the kids that were raised in the cities.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't take quite so much training, I don't think.
Yeah. Did they have, did you put them through fire school and...
Yeah, they had their own firefighting and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, most of them have been on fires around here, spot fires and little fires here throughout the summer since they were probably 16, you know, get out on the fire somewhere, something like that.
Yeah.
So they were pretty well educated on the working and firefighting end of it, even though they were still just getting out of school.
Mm-hmm.
Where the kids from in the colleges are back east, more or less, had never been on a fire or something like that. So they took quite a little training.
You got people from back east to come out here?
Oh, yeah, they had them from all over.
Recruiting.
That's what I said. I didn't know too much about that because Francis was the main squeeze on that.
Yeah.
He got the interviews down through the Okanagan supervisor's office, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So, he could give you a lot of good information.
Great.
But he's been kind of sick lately. I don't know how he's getting on. I imagine he's... Have you called Connie?
Let's see. Yeah, he's coming tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Three.
Sorry. Well, you get a lot of first-hand information because he's got a good memory and he was right from the word go on the whole business.
Great. Excuse me. Anything, did you ever see a lot of people wash out during the...
Not very many, one or two was all. One or two was all.
Hmm. Nobody got hurt during...
No, they didn't get hurt. They just decided that wasn't what they wanted to do.
Right.
Get pretty badly scared. They've never been up in the air either. That's another thing.
Hmm.
Around. It makes quite a little difference too, I think. Of course, I think the first time... I was up for the second time. I went up for a ride once, and then the next time I had to jump. So that was about the way it was. Or I did jump, anyways.
Yeah.
I never been up in airplanes very much at that time. I don't think any of the other locals had either, really, been up in airplanes very much.
Mm. So this was a new airport then at that time?
Yeah, just a strip down through here. Dirt.
Brand new for the
dirt strip. Yeah, the Okanagan County or the American Legion, I think, had possession of this here. They'd gradually grubbed out a little landing strip, and then so when after the Forest Service took it in, they started clearing it more and more all the time.
Wow. What kind of training did you put people through during your during the period that, say, after 43 or whatever? What did they do? Did you do any medical training with them or that kind of thing?
No, medical.
Yeah.
No.
Just firefighting.
Just first aid or something like that. Yeah, yeah. First aid. Yeah, they got first aid training and stuff like that.
And jumping and firefighting.
Jumping and firefighting and how to fall and how to get out of the plane and that stuff. That just all first aid in case somebody broke his arm or cracked an ankle or something like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anybody do that?
Oh, yeah, there's several of them that sprained ankles and stuff like that. Yeah. But they was so far but what they could get in and the doctor, get to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Hurt a knee or leg or something like that.
Yeah. Good. Well, I think
okay.
That might be about it here.